This is the sixth day of this January 2010 Rohatsu Sesshin. And today we'll take up a koan. This one is from the Mumonkan, Gateless Barrier. It's number 46, near the end. Step forward from the top of a 100-foot pole. All the stories about Hakuin that we've been reading up to now in Sesshin led me to this koan this morning, as I think some of you will be able to understand as we go on. Here's the case. We'll use the Chinese name because it's not that difficult to pronounce, Shishuang. The Japanese name is Sekiso. Shishuang said, "How can you step forward from the top of a 100-foot pole?" Another ancient master said, "You who sit at the top of a 100-foot pole, although you have entered the way, are not yet genuine. Take a step from the top of the 100-foot pole and reveal your whole body in the 10 directions." We'll save Mumon's commentary and verse for later. We're going back now from the time of Hakuin across the Japan Sea to China and back about 500 years to this Master Shishuang, who lived from 986 to 1039. I'm reading now from the book called Zen's Chinese Heritage. Shishuang left home at the age of 22, meaning he became a monk at the age of 22. He heard that a certain Fan Yang had an unsurpassed Zen style, so he went with a group of other monks to train under that master. 2 years of severe frustration followed, as Fan Yang would not even allow Shishuang into his room for an interview. Wouldn't let him come to Doksan for 2 years. On each occasion that Shishuang met his teacher, he was subjected to a scolding. Fan Yang seemed to hurl abuse everywhere, and his training appeared to Shishuang to be little more than a stream of vulgarity. So, feeling he is making no progress, Shishuang finally poured out his frustration to the master. "I've been here for 2 years, and you haven't given me any instruction. You've just increased the world's vulgarity, dust, and toil, while the years and months fly away. Even what I knew before is no longer clear." That's good. "And I've lost whatever good came from leaving home." Before Shishuang could finish speaking, Fan Yang glared at him fiercely and cursed him, saying, "What you know is vile. How dare you sell me short?" And saying that, Fan Yang picked up his staff to drive Shishuang away. Shishuang tried to plead with him, but Fan Yang covered Shishuang's mouth with his hand. At that moment, Shishuang realized great enlightenment. And after that, Shishuang remained as Feng Yang's attendant for 7 years. And then, as is typical in the records of these old masters, it just skips right to some dialogues of when Shi Shuang himself had become a master. And we'll read some of those. Shi Shuang entered the hall and addressed the monks, saying, "All of the Buddhas and all of the Buddhas Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi," that is Supreme Perfect Enlightenment, "all of the Buddhas and all of the Buddhas Supreme Enlightenment come forth from this sutra." He then raised his staff upright and said, "This is the Nanyuan Temple staff. Where is the sutra?" After a long pause, he said, "The text is long. I'll give it to you later." Then, with a shout, he got down from the seat. Another time, Shi Shuang entered the hall and said, "If a teacher of our school can snatch a jewel off of the clothes of an impoverished man, then he can be said to have reached the stage of person. If not, then he's a mud and water fellow." After a pause, Shi Shuang said, "If you meet a swordsman on the road, show him the jeweled sword. If he's not a poet, don't offer him a poem. Shi Shuang shouted. This refers, of course, to the role of a teacher to strip the student of what he clings to and what he imagines he needs. So when he says that if a teacher of our school can snatch a jewel off of the clothes of an impoverished man, then he can be said to have reached the stage of person. I'm reminded of a phrase in Theravadan Buddhism, which when translated means person, and it refers to one who upholds the precepts. If you don't uphold the precepts, then you're not considered fully human, fully a person. But here, Shi Shuang is not talking about precepts. This saying, if you meet a swordsman on the road, show him the sword. If he's not a poet, don't offer him a poem, was a popular saying at the time in China. And it became, Mumon included it as another koan in his collection here. Another time he entered the hall and said, "I have a word that cuts off thinking and leaves cause and effect behind. But even clever people can't speak it. It may only be transmitted by way of mind. There is another word that may only be directly expressed. What is the word that can only be directly expressed?" After a pause, Shi Shuang drew a circle in the air with his staff. Then he shouted. The shout seemed to be kind of the period he put on each of his statements. A monk asked Shi Shuang, "I don't ask about the leaves picked off the branches. What is the actual root?" Shi Shuang said, "A willow wood staff." That would be the staff that the teacher held, was made of willow often. "A willow wood staff." The monk said, "What does that mean?" Xishuang said, "When a monk goes traveling, he carries his clothes with it on his shoulders. When he sits, he holds it in his hand." And then one more here. Xishuang received honors from the emperor, and during the return trip to his temple, he said to his attendant, "I feel a paralyzing wind." Xishuang's mouth became crooked. His attendant stopped and said, "What should we do? You've spent your whole life cursing the Buddhas and reviling the ancestors. So now what can you do?" Xishuang said, "Don't worry. I'll straighten it for you." And then he used his hand to straighten his mouth. End of story. He died relatively young, only 53. He taught at several different temples and is said to have had 50 Dharma heirs. The two most famous of whom were Yang Qi and Huang Long, each of whom established distinctive branches of the Lin Qi Zen line, the Rinzai school. So Hakuin would have been very familiar with this Xishuang. Go any further, I'd like to talk just a little bit about koans and their value in practice. They are meant to free us from the constraints of our discriminating mind so that we can awaken to our true nature in our body. We can embody the truths that the koans point to. They demand that and nothing less. The best description one of the best descriptions I know of about the value of koans is not even referring to koans. It's written by... it starts off that way, talking about koans, but then it quotes a Heinrich Zimmer. I'll read the whole thing. "The great merit of koans, which range over the vast area of the Mahayana teachings, is that they compel us in ingenious and often dramatic fashion to learn these doctrines not simply with our head but with our whole being, refusing to permit us to sit back and endlessly theorize about them in the abstract." What Heinrich Zimmer says about certain types of meditation is especially true of koans, the spirit of which must be demonstrated and not merely explained. And this is what Zimmer says about knowledge, not referring to koans, but it's perfect for koans. "Knowledge is the reward of action, for it is by doing things that one becomes transformed. Executing a symbolical gesture, actually living through to the very limit a particular role, one comes to realize the truth inherent in the role. Suffering its consequences, one fathoms and exhausts its contents." A lot of koans involve role-playing, and it's when we have to inhabit a role that we come to understand it in a new way, because we have to have our body involved in it. And the actor knows how important it is to become. You have to become the character. And once you become the character, then you understand the character in a new way. I remember working on koans with Roshi Kaplow, and in our our exchange, I would realize the point of the koan, and he knew I understood the point of the koan by what I said, but he would insist that I actually demonstrate it, which might mean, you know, getting up and doing what he and I both knew I knew, but I didn't know it enough until I actually did it in my body. I came to really appreciate that it does have to be embodied. That's really what all of this work is about, all of our work in Zen. It's not just getting it, so to speak, in our head, but then embodying it. In fact, that's another version of the four vows, the last line of the four vows. Not the great way of Buddha I vow to attain, but the great way of Buddha I vow to embody, to incorporate the truth. Now, this reference to stepping forward from the top of a 100-foot pole didn't originate with Shi Shuang. He got it from a still earlier master by the name of Changsha. Changsha and a monk by the name of Hui trained together under the great Nanshuan, Nansen in Japanese. These two eventually became independent, practicing on their own. Changsha became the abbot of a large training center, whereas Hui went to live in a hermitage in the mountains. And one day, Changsha wondered, how is Brother Hui getting along these days? So he sent a monk to look in on him, and he gave the monk instructions about what to say. So the monk made his way up to the hermitage in the mountains, and when he got there, he asked Hui, what about when you had not yet met Nanshuan? This would be a way of saying, what about before awakening? We just sat quietly. The monk asked, what about after you met Nanshuan? And Hui said, nothing special. The monk then returned to Changsha and told him what had happened. And that's when Changsha said, you who sit on the top of a 100-foot pole, although you have entered the way, it is not yet genuine. Take a step from the top of the pole, and worlds of the 10 directions are your total body. This story that I just read about Changsha and Hui appears in another collection of koans, the Shoyo Roku, or the Book of Serenity, number 79, and it has its own name, Changsha, advancing a step. And there are some commentaries about it. And the author of the Shoyoroku here says this comment by Changsha, the man sitting atop the 100-foot pole, though he's gained entry, this is not yet the real. This and Yan Tao's saying to Shui Feng that Deshan didn't know the last word are troubled about the same thing. Let me get that reference clear. This is when, in a koan in the Mumonkan, where the head cook sees the old master Toksan coming with his bowl in his hand too early for lunch, and he takes him to task for it, and later tells another senior monk, and that senior monk comments, "Old Toksan has not yet grasped the last word of Zen." So here, this author is saying that statement, he hasn't grasped the last word of Zen. That one, and this one, that the guy on the top of the 100-foot pole hasn't really grasped it yet, are troubled about the same thing. I always tell people that it's much like having taken their grandparents' house and business and their relatives themselves and sold them off on the same ticket, then put it in a crystal jar which you keep with you wherever you are, guarding it like your eyeballs. Don't let me see. I'd surely pick it up and smash it, making your hands free, folks joyfully alive with no taboos. He's referring here in that last words to the freedom that comes from stepping forward off the top of the 100-foot pole. So in this, with this koan, it's two main points for the student to demonstrate. The first is that state of being at the top of the 100-foot pole, and then the second is stepping forward from the top of the 100-foot pole. It doesn't take a lot of imagination to understand that the top of the 100-foot pole is enlightenment. Enlightenment is of different degrees. This would be a deep state of enlightenment. And what does that mean? One doesn't have to have realized deep enlightenment to have seen into the essence of awakening. This takes us back to Hakuin. Notice how he was treated by his teacher, Shouju. Hakuin went, after his first enlightenment, he went parading around. He said something like, a splendid enlightenment like this has not been known for 300 years. Well, there he is at the top of the 100-foot pole. And his teacher's job was to knock him off it. That's why he delivered such harsh treatment, because he knew that being at the top of the pole is not what this is all about. What good are you going to do anyone up there at the top of the pole? if enlightenment, the value of enlightenment has to be the degree to which we can bring it into our life and not just hold on to it as a precious commodity in our mind that we've acquired. We have to go beyond the awakening. An ancient Zen master said, having some attainment is the jackal's yelp. Having no attainment is the lion's roar. This is demanded in Zen, as always has been. You read it in the literature, you read it in the koans, one master after another, insisting that we have to let go of our enlightenment. What does that mean? Of course, it doesn't mean letting go of the experience. You've had the experience. How could you let go even if you wanted to? It's letting go of the idea of it. And that idea can be so pernicious, such a contaminant in the mind, as it was after that first awakening of Hakuin. This is the stink of enlightenment. We have to outgrow that. And then in the koan, in the case, you who sit at the top of a 100-foot pole, although you have entered the way, you are not yet genuine. Take a step from the top of the 100-foot pole and reveal your whole body in the 10 directions. When the Buddha, after his supreme awakening, remained seated for what we're told was 7 weeks, just savoring the rapture of this enlightenment that had not been known before, this unimaginably profound enlightenment, when he just kept sitting for those 7 weeks, it was not yet genuine. So when he stood up and walked, that he became genuine. This is this letting go of one's attainment, whatever it may be, and it's something that the student is hammered on all through the koans. Many koans deal with this, and it's not only after an awakening experience. It's what is called, we're called on to do. Every step of the way, wherever we get, we may not get at the top of the pole, but even short of that, we get 5 feet up, 10 feet up. Any time we find that we have got into a different level of practice, any time we find that we have gained some kind of insight, our job then is to discard it. Get rid of it. Let it go. It's the hardest thing in the world. We've been working so long and so hard, and suddenly things open, what 99 out of 100 people, at least, do is sit and think about it, basically. Even if they're not patting themselves on the back, which is usually the case, and congratulating themselves, then is some process of analyzing it, thinking about it in one way or another, and then we're caught. What is a wonderful thing, even a lesser insight, which is an inspiring and wonderful thing, immediately ferments and becomes an impediment. So hard to not think about a state of sudden new state of clarity, openness, brightness in the mind. But clinging to it in this way, then it right away we are crippled by it, by the clinging, and things close in again, fold in on itself, and we're back to work. Everything in us wants to just savor it, just enjoy it for a while. Is that asking for too much? Just licking our chops but no. Sure, we can do that. We can spend a whole session. We can spend multiple sessions thinking about that experience we had that was so liberating. But then we're going nowhere. Rinzai himself spoke of this, the imperative of letting go of things. He put it in his own style. He says, whatever you encounter, either within or without, slay it at once. On meeting a Buddha, slay the Buddha. On meeting a patriarch, slay the patriarch. On meeting an arhat, slay the arhat. On meeting your parents, slay your parents. On meeting your kinsmen, slay your kinsmen, and you attain emancipation. By not cleaving to things, you freely pass through. And then Mumon's commentary. If you can step forward and turn about, is there anything to reject as unworthy? Be that as it may, tell me, how do you proceed onward from the top of a 100-foot pole? Go! In Zen literature, there is an image that various painters have had a hand in painting, and it's Shakyamuni descending from the mountain. The way up the mountain is coming to enlightenment, but then you're only halfway. Then there is the descending the mountain, coming back. A Chinese master asked another master, I'm doing this from memory, when you are reborn, after you die, where will you be reborn? And he said, I want to come back and be a water buffalo in the village below. Or maybe he said, after you reach the top of the mountain, where will you go? I want to go down to the village below and be a water buffalo. Water buffalo being a a symbol for service and service to others. And then Mumon's verse, the eye in the forehead has gone blind, and he clings to the mark on the scale. He has thrown away his body and laid down his life. He is only a blind man leading the blind. The eye in the forehead has gone blind. So long as we cling to the top of this pole, clinging to the mark on the scale, this becomes a memory. What good is that? What is that good for? It's not good for oneself. It's not good for anyone else. Just chewing on a memory. He's thrown away his body and laid down his life. He's only a blind man leading the blind. This verse is very rich in different angles, different ways to understand it. A Chinese master wrote a verse about this, not today's koan exactly, but the whole thing of the original story of reaching the top of the 100-foot pole and then not stepping forward, the monk in the mountains. This is what he said. The jade man's dream is shattered. One call from the rooster. Looking around on life, all colors are equal. Wind and thunder, with news of events, roust out the hibernating insects. Peach trees, wordless, naturally make a path. When the time and season comes, laboring at the plow, who fears the spring rose knee-deep mud? Who fears the spring rose knee-deep mud? There's that elevated state at the top of the pole, that pure, clean world of enlightenment as a memory or as an abstraction. And then there's stepping forward, coming back to the four vows, these vows that when they are recited with our whole mind, it said can extend for lifetimes, that vow, those four. We'll stop now and recite those vows.